Join us every Tuesday
from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern
on The People Speak with host Basma Farhat,
as she interviews guests from the realms of politics,
activism,
spirituality,
literature,
science,
and other social issues.
The People Speak provides a forum
for live audience interaction,
allowing you to speak with guests
and for them to hear and answer you.
This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, we make a difference. Today, the people speak with a courageous man that has made a difference, Congressman Paul Finley, author of the famous book, They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, book, Silent War, Confronting America's False Islam.
Hello?
Good evening, everyone. Hello, and this is Basma Farhat, host of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, we make a difference. Today, the people speak the courageous man, a man that has indeed made a difference, Congressman Paul Finley, author of a famous book, They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. And he's also the author of his latest book, Silent No More. Silent No More, Confronting America's False Image of Islam. Welcome to our show, sir. Hello, Congressman?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
Right here.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Good. You're coming through loud and clear. How are you,
okay,
Congressman? It is an honor having you with us this evening, sir.
Well, it's my pleasure. They address me as the Honorable occasionally, but I don't think that's an earned degree.
And why is that, sir?
Well, it's a habit that goes with the job of being a member of Congress. It's kind of like being a colonel in Kentucky. It doesn't mean very much, but it's nice to hear.
Well, I'll tell you what, Congressman. As far as I'm concerned, you're still the kind of person that we need in our government. A year after the September 11 attack, you published an article saying that this attack would never have occurred were it not for the uncritical U.S. support of Israel. In that same article, you wrote that the U.S. policy on the Middle East is made in Israel, not in Washington, and that a once-beloved worldwide U.S. government finds itself reviled in most countries due because it provides unconditional support of Israeli violations. These are huge statements, sir.
They are indeed, and they will probably shock people who haven't really looked into Middle Eastern history of recent date. but they're the truth. They're the absolute truth. The book that you cited, They Dare to Speak Out, was published in 1985. It has sold over 300,000 copies. I have yet to have anyone file suit against the text of the book or raise serious questions about accuracy. It's a book that tells exactly how the lobby for the State of Israel came into being, the methods they use, the history of their own organization, and the effect that they've had on the U.S. national interest, which is profound. Now, since I wrote that book, and let me back up a minute, when I wrote the book, I frankly did not know the details of how the lobby functioned. But I had the good fortune to be able to interview personally probably 100 people at least, maybe 150, and I never had a single one turn me down, refuse to be interviewed. Now, some of them asked me never to identify themselves as a source of information they gave me, but they said that they would stand by what they told me should the question be raised in court where I might be on the defensive, which tells me that the book had a wide enough circulation to attract all of the potential critics of my position. And had they had a case to bring against me, they would have brought it and probably had me in court. But that has not happened. In fact, the book still sells. And at some point during our discussion, I'd be glad to give a toll-free number where people can buy a copy if they'd like to have it.
Absolutely. We will definitely announce that. Mr. Finley, when we hear about these, you were a target of the lobby, the Israeli lobby, for many years while you were in Congress, were you not?
Well, the targeting became very intense in 1978. That's the year that I had two personal interviews with Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO at that time, since deceased. That made me the public enemy number one of the lobby because they disapproved thoroughly of anyone meeting with Arafat. They considered him a demon that should not be allowed in our country, and for many years, the government of the state of the U.S. Cooperated by keeping any official of the PLO out of the country. They treated them as vermin, not to be admitted for fear they would infect people with the wrong ideas and cause a lot of trouble. Well, fortunately, that has changed. But unfortunately, the damage done over the years to public perception has been so deep, so powerful, that today there is no one on Capitol Hill with one exception. And that one exception is a representative from Texas named Ron Paul. He will occasionally speak up and challenge the State of Israel and our relationship with that state. But no one else will. There are no hearings, no discussions worthy of the term debate, and there have not been any such discussions. And I speak from personal experience of 22 years as a member of the House and a close identification with the House ever since. There is no debate of U.S. Middle East policy that is worthy of that name. And here we take such pride in our Congress. The Senate is often saluted as the world's greatest debating society. And there is never, never any open discussion of the role of Israel on U.S. policy in the Senate today. Now, there used to be a few senators who would speak out. One was Senator Fulbright of Arkansas. Another was Adlai Stevenson of Illinois. Another was Charles Percy, also of Illinois. In fact, Percy was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when the lobby decided that he ought to be out of the Congress, and they claimed credit for his defeat in 1984. And they also claimed credit for my defeat in 1982. And, of course, when my former
That's
colleague,
awfully arrogant
another,
of them, isn't
go
it,
ahead,
sir?
Go ahead, excuse me. I'm
I was saying that's awfully
much.
Arrogant of them, isn't it?
Well, indeed that is. I didn't mean to speak at such length. I'll wait for your question.
Oh, not at all. This is all about you, Congressman. We are here to hear your statements. I just find that when you talk about this, the audacity of the Israeli lobby, the power that it has wielded in domestic and foreign policy in our country, here you tell us that to this day no one dares oppose them, and those that do oppose them have lost their positions. How do we, as an American society, regain control of our country and take it away
well,
from Israel?
The first thing
sir?
We have to do is regain control of the right to free speech. Because today, if you'll settle back and think about it, the same silence that pervades the Capitol Hill in Washington pervades almost the entire country. There is almost never anything that could rightly be called a civilized discussion of the influence of the State of Israel in the United States. Never, from coast to coast, border to border. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a coffee klatch in a Midwestern village or a gathering of prominent academics or theologians. Even the people who are tenured in universities are afraid to speak out. Fear is the word that has to be used to explain what's happening to our country. Let me add just another dimension for your consideration. I watched the Democratic candidates for the presidency. I guess it was the night before last. I enjoyed the hour-and-a-half debate. I thought it was edifying in many, many respects. But do you remember anyone bringing up the role of the State of Israel in our national affairs? After all, it's a very valid question. We would not have suffered 9/11 had it not been for Israel. We would not be in a war in Iraq had it not been for Israel. The only country urging us to get into that war was the State of Israel. And there, Israel has such a lock on our governmental political system that they got what they wanted. Well, now there is talk about a war against Iran. And here again, the only country that is out front urging that we go to war against Iran is the State of Israel. If we attack Israel, believe me, it'll be for Israel, not for the American national interest. It's really a terrifying situation when you think about it carefully that the silence, the absence of debate, is so pervasive that here the world's only superpower militarily, is so frightened about a country of about 5 million people that it's afraid to discuss openly the impact that country has had on our national policy.
Let me ask you, do you think that we will be attacking Iran? From all
I'm
the
afraid
indications?
That there will be an assault. It may possibly be initiated actually by the Israelis. They have the means to do it. We've given them everything we have in the way of high-tech military hardware. So they could be the initiator of this, although I'm sure they would prefer that we do the fighting as we have in Iraq. But they certainly are are strongly opposed to Iran acquiring nuclear capability for weapons. I don't know if anybody is eager about Iran having nuclear weapons, but after all, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, India does, Israel does, and the U.S. has them, and so does the government of Great Britain. So they're surrounded by people that they may at some time or other be anxious about, and they will probably at some date, if not now, someday, they will feel it's necessary for their own national interest to have the deterrent of nuclear weapons. I don't advocate it. I hope it doesn't happen. But I think in the normal course of events, it's almost bound to occur.
Well, let me ask you, Congressman, how does the Israeli threat, this concept of nuclear ambiguity on the part of Israel, how does it affect the security of the Middle East right now?
Well, it it of course is provocative. It's fearsome. I'm sure that Iraq is afraid that they will be subjected to a nuclear attack. Some of our super bunker busters use nuclear weapon force to dig the big deep holes that the bombs cause. Israel has these bunker busters in its arsenal, and I think it's a natural concern on the part of Iran. Now, I wish that the president of Iran was a little bit more temperate in his choice of words, and I wish he would speak in English occasionally so that there is never any question about what he says through translation. He is accused of saying that Israel ought to be wiped out off the face of the earth. Now, I have seen a number of scholarly treatises on that question, and each of them have claimed that what he demanded was that colonial Israel be eliminated, not Israel itself. It's the colonial relationship Israel has with the Palestinians that infuriates Iran and all of the Arab countries, too.
Mr. Finley, one of the things that I think is the most interesting of the book, and I think was the most appealing for many people, is this issue of espionage. You spoke of Israeli espionage, breaches of security by Israel, the USS Liberty. Why is it that Israel is allowed to get away with murder?
Well, they are allowed to get away literally with murder, not a figure of speech, but literally.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely.
Because back in 1967, they knew that the USS Liberty was an unarmed Navy ship patrolling in international waters, no threat whatever to Israel, and yet for reasons that I think I can explain, they did their best to destroy the ship and everybody aboard the ship. So they thought by doing that, by erasing every trace of the USS Liberty, they could plant the rumor that an Egyptian warship did the damage, that Egypt was responsible, and that would create such an uproar of sentiment in America that the U.S. would quickly and automatically almost become an ally of Israel in its military conquest of Arab states. Now, they almost succeeded with that scheme. It was just because some of the sailors on the ship were able to harbor together a makeshift antenna and get one SOS out that was heard by the USS America, one of our aircraft carriers nearby. That carrier immediately launched aircraft intended to go to the rescue, to the defense of the Liberty. even though it was quite apparent to a lot of people that Israel was the one that was causing the trouble. Well, no sooner were the aircraft launched than the White House informed of the launching of the intended defense of the Liberty by our own fighter aircraft, ordered the ships, the airships, back to the carrier. The defense of the USS Liberty never occurred. The first time in the history of the U.S. Navy that a ship of the Navy was left defenseless by other craft of the Navy that could have come to its rescue. It's a very sorry story. It shows, though, very specifically that literally Israel is willing to commit the murder of U.S. citizens, namely U.S. sailors, in order to advance what it thinks are the best interests of its country.
Sir, as an Arab American Palestinian heritage, I know the capacity of Israel to for killing. What I don't understand, though, is Lyndon Baines Johnson, in his own memoirs, continued and actually perpetuated the lie. Why do presidents of this country do that and turn against their own citizens that have been attacked? And if anything, as far as I'm concerned, the USS Liberty was a direct act of war. And yet Lyndon Baines Johnson said it was okay, literally.
Question. I'm not the very best person to answer it, but I've made quite a careful study of that event, that fateful June the 8th of 1967. I talked with a naval officer who had been badly wounded on the Liberty. When he was transferred by helicopter to the USS America, the aircraft carrier, as soon as they could give him some medical care, his eyelids had been seared shut by the enormity of the hot blast that tore a 40-foot hole in the side of the ship. Let me back up just a little bit. This was an assault during daylight. Israeli planes had circled the ship during the morning hours. They knew exactly what it was. They reported this back, and the high command of Israel said, sink the ship. And they did their level best to do that. They used torpedo boats that ripped this enormous hole in the hull. They used aircraft, fighter aircraft, to strafe the decks, to shoot up the rubber life rafts that were dropped into the water during a moment when the captain was about ready to abandon ship. They destroyed all the life rafts, so it was apparent they were trying to destroy the ship and everybody aboard the ship. Now, why did Lyndon Johnson refuse to send help? I talked to this man whose eyelids had been seared by the heat shot. They lanced the eyelids, and fortunately his eyesight, even though his eyeballs were almost covered with flakes of burned paint, he nevertheless was able to get around, and he reported to the Admiral, Admiral Geis, G-I-E-S, who was the commander of the ship. And the Admiral had called on this Lieutenant Commander to come. He had something very private to tell him, and he closed the door to his cabin, and the Admiral said that he had just hung up the phone from receiving a call from the Situation Room of the White House. He had talked with Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, Defense at the time. He also talked last to Lyndon B. Johnson personally. And Admiral Geis said he wanted to report what was said in that conversation, and he chose this Lieutenant Commander, his name is Davis, to receive the word. And when Geis was told by McNamara to call back the aircraft and not let them defend the Liberty, Admiral Geis was so dumbfounded at the order that he said, "Mr. Secretary, I respectfully appeal that order to higher authority." Well, Lyndon B. Johnson's voice came on the phone, and he said, "This is higher authority. Get those fighter planes back to the America." He said, "I don't care, I don't give a damn if the ship sinks and everyone on it drowns. I will not embarrass our ally." Those were his exact words as reported by Admiral Geis to this lieutenant commander, with whom I've had a number of conversations just to make sure that I have the wording exactly right. I also verified the text by talking with a radio man who at the time was stationed in Morocco and had a hand in patching the call from the White House over to the aircraft carrier. And he verified the language I just gave you. The commander-in-chief of the military forces of the United States, including the USS Liberty, ordered fighter aircraft to go back, stating that he didn't give a damn if the ship sunk and everybody on it drowned. Now, that shows the depth.
This is the president of
the influence of the lobby for the state of Israel. They obviously had Lyndon B. Johnson in their pocket. I have some evidence as to why Lyndon behaved that way, but the behavior occurred, and 34 USS sailors died in the assault. They were shot to death on the deck or killed when the torpedoes blasted big holes in the side of the ship. It's one of the most unbelievable stories in the history of the United States of America. It's one that really saddens me to think that the commander-in-chief, the commander of the Liberty, would refuse to let fighter aircraft defend that ship from assault.
It is truly an amazing and stunning situation. You know,
and let me add just another little chapter
this. Please do.
At that time, U.S. aid to the state of Israel was pretty minimal. I think it was around $70 million a year. That's a lot of money, in my opinion, but it's trivial compared with what's happened since. In other words, I have evidence that the National Security Advisor to Lyndon Johnson told the ambassador from Israel that the Vietnam War, in which we were then engaged, was such a drain on U.S. finances that they might not be able to maintain the level of aid at around $70 million a year. Well, in the wake of the Liberty attack, there was a thorough cover-up that occurred. The sailors who survived the attack heard an admiral come to them while some of them still in hospital beds, injured from the experience. They were all threatened with court-martial if they said anything about what actually happened during the day of the attack on the Liberty. That cover-up has prevailed ever since. It's still the official position of the official position of the Department of Defense is the lie that the State of Israel used to try to explain what happened. They claimed it was mistaken identity, that they thought they were hitting an Egyptian warship. Of course, it was a lie because in broad daylight that prevailed that day, due to the numerous reconnaissance flights that were made around the Liberty that day, they knew exactly the ship that they were trying to destroy. But for whatever reason, Lyndon Johnson wanted to protect Israel from any embarrassment. He immediately accepted that lie as the from the State of Israel. And even in, I believe it was in his autobiography, that he dismissed the whole episode by saying that just a half a dozen sailors were killed.
Just amazing, absolutely amazing. Another thing that I find equally as amazing is the understanding that somehow this Judeo-Christian alliance has emerged within our spiritual community, sir, Jerry Falwell, all of the other, all the way down, as far back as even Oral Roberts. We have this pervasive change in the understanding of Scripture, and yet we have people who, I think in your book, Reverend Don Wagner, a Presbyterian minister, took a good portion of your time in the book, They Dare to Speak Out, and I've met Don on a couple of occasions, and the last time he was at our church, and he was a guest speaker for the Sabeel Conference. Sabeel is a Christian organization, and Don at that time, Congressman, coined the term the Likudization of American government. How accurate is that statement today?
Well, it's very troubling. I'm a Presbyterian. I think most people consider the Presbyterian Church one of the mainline Protestant churches. I have written a book called Silent No More, Confronting America's False Images of Islam, because long before 9/11, I perceived a serious problem in this country. So many people had a totally wrong impression of Islam. They were afraid of Muslims. They thought they were out to get America and destroy America as a government, and our Constitution as an institution. And so I spent about 3 years writing this book called Silent No More. Then it came out a couple of months before 9/11. And, of course, 9/11 began this new wave of anti-Muslim sentiment because the people believed to have caused 9/11 were all professed Muslims. So, naturally, the American people who didn't know any better thought that they were following their faith and carrying out this suicide bombing that was so destructive to American lives. Personally, I know that they were not acting as Muslims when they did that. Islam teaches against suicide. It teaches against harming innocent people. So the suicide bombers that are at work in Iraq these days and elsewhere may profess to be Muslims, but they are not true to their faith.
And may I ask you, sir, how powerful is this idea within our Christian community here? I don't know if you've gone to some of the or witnessed some of the evangelic ceremonious positions that they have. These people are off the wall with their hatred and their, you know, they claim to love Israel at the cost of an entire nation of people, the Palestinians. How Christian is that?
It is a dreadful phenomenon. I don't pretend to understand just how they gain this idea and this strength, but they are very numerous. The people that follow the doctrine of Jerry Falwell and the others follow a very, very strange, I think ridiculous, interpretation of the book of Revelation. They believe that the second coming of Christ will be a showdown off the coast of the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, that the forces of good, namely led by Jesus Christ, will prevail over the forces of evil. And at that moment, they believed that all Jews will be either destroyed or converted instantly to Christianity. Now, this is the fundamental doctrine, believe it or not, of the people who are so swept up with their fervor for the state of Israel. They also believe that a part of God's plan prior to that great battle over Armageddon plain, that part of God's plan is to have Israel remain strong, united, and militarily powerful. So this, I guess, is the excuse they offer for wanting to support Israel in its determination to reestablish greater Israel way back 2,000 years, and also to embrace the government of Israel in its determination to eliminate any statehood for the Palestinians. But there, you know, there's another religious force at work here. The ultra-Orthodox Jews believe that their Messiah, not Jesus, but their own Jewish Messiah, will not come until the entirety of Great Israel is intact, which means the conquest of all of the West Bank to make it a part of the state of Israel. And they too, like the Christian Zionists, are believers. They believe in this rather ridiculous doctrine. And that means that they fight to their last breath to oppose the establishment of a new Palestine on any part of what historic Palestine existed. It's a very messy scene that we face, and religion is a part of every avenue.
Amazing. Now, we do have a number of guests, callers, that want to ask you questions, Congressman. But before they do, I really want to address something that I find that, again, along with the role of America, the role of our the Christian Zionist movement that is in America, we also have an issue with the media in this country, the Zionist-controlled media. I know that you are on the Chief Executive Board of Americans Only New, along with Allison Weir, the creator of the site, and she also did what she called the report card, the media report card.
Yeah.
Now, Allison has been on our show, as a matter of fact, just a few weeks ago, and this is an astounding, astounding scenario. Can you talk to us about the control of the media in this country?
I can indeed. Every segment of our society is afraid of Israel. Is afraid of Israel. That sounds like a crazy statement, but it's a fact. Now, the media is no exception. The lobby for the state of Israel has intimidated the media just as thoroughly as it has intimidated our political structure in Washington, D.C. You can listen to the evening news, the CNN all day long if you want to. You will never hear a single syllable that says, reports anything shady about the state of Israel. Jimmy Carter wrote a book that has become quite controversial, and I salute him for it. He is the first public official of great prominence who has been willing to talk critically about the other Israel, as he calls it. There's one Israel that is the idealistic vision of the founders of the State of Israel many years ago. Then there's the other Israel that is never talked about, the one that has visited terrible crimes of abuse and murder and mayhem and destruction against the Palestinian people. The Palestinians are treated like cattle. They are cordoned off within high walls and fences. They're separated in many cases from their own farmland, and the government of Israel is responsible, but the American people are also responsible because we have permitted our government to be terrified about the state of Israel itself. And our government has lavished billions and billions of dollars on Israel without condition, without any qualification. Immediately beginning with the destruction of USS Liberty by LBJ's order, the aid to Israel began to jump into the buildings. That was a major turning point in our relationship with Israel. We not only had the destruction of the Liberty, the murder of sailors, we not only had the cover-up of that dreadful incident to this very day, but it also was a turning point in history of our relationship with the State of Israel, beginning with LBJ's decision that day. Anything Israel wanted, they got. The sky was the limit, and the sky has gone higher and higher every year.
It certainly has, to the tune of unbelievable and disproportionate
Let me add just a word about politics. I have always, up until the last few years, been very proud to be a Republican. I was elected a Republican member of the House for 11 terms. That was 22 years. I've come to be ashamed of the behavior of not just the administration, the president, and his staff, but of the Congress. It's a source of shame for me to see what's happening on Capitol Hill in relationship to the Middle East and to the power of the lobby. We have a lot of people running for president this year. You'll be hard put to find any one of them, Democrat or Republican, raise a serious question about the shady side, the bloody side, the criminal side of the state of Israel. But it's there. It has spread fear across our country in a phenomenon that is without precedent in American history. And where will we find the remedy if we can't find it in the person who is president of the United States? Where can we expect to find the remedy? It's a very disturbing scene we face.
Absolutely.
And by the way, let me add, those who would like to buy any of my books can do so by calling 1-800-368-5788. 1-800-368-5788. Thank you.
You heard it here, folks. You can also get it at Amazon.com. I know that for a fact.
Because, oh, good. Thank you for adding that.
Yes, sir. Yes, you can get it there. Believe me, that's where I got my copy. One of the things that I'd like to also say is that the book, They Dare to Speak Out, is already in its third print after as many years as it has been around. That is a phenomenal accomplishment. Obviously, people from 1985 to 2003 are still looking to see what's going on in the world today. Congressman, we have some questions from our audience.
Excuse me. Go ahead, please.
Oh, go right. Please do continue. I just wanted to get some of our audience questions here.
Oh, sure. And go right ahead.
And for those of you that would like to call in, you can call this the number on our screen, toll free internationally. I will announce it in just a minute. Our first question is coming from Matt from Kansas. Matt, will you please come to the line and talk to the congressman?
Yes, Congressman. Do you think the 9/11 investigation was a fair investigation, or do you think it was an inside job? Thank you, sir.
I wish I had the answer. I have read a lot about the possibility that it was an inside job. But I think it's unsettled, and I don't know if it ever will be settled. But I do know that the state of Israel has shown its willingness to kill American citizens to try to advance its own goals. So I think we'll have to be open to all kinds of possibilities as time goes on. Let me add this also. Osama bin Laden has made several public statements in which he he points out that the Muslim world, and of course that includes the Arab world too, is outraged against America mainly because of our complicity in Israel's destruction of the Palestinian community, its humiliation of all those Palestinians. And this cuts deeply because every Muslim believes that when any Muslim is hurt unjustly, this hurts every Muslim. And so the outrage against America is quite understandable, and we have a lot of repair work to do if we're ever to regain that pinnacle of that I saluted so joyfully when I was in the World War II and since. I always felt that while America has made some mistakes, it has always tried to do what is best for our country. But we have deviated from that path because of the overwhelming, thorough, terrifying, intimidating influence of the lobby for the State of Israel. In fact, George Ball was once an ambassador to the UN, and he told me that there are several devices the pro-Israeli people use to intimidate the United States. One of them is that they all always vote. Their voting percentage is way up in the 90s. He said they're willing to give generously of their own money, and that's true. They contributed about 90% of the money that came against me in 1980 and again in 1982. Without that money, none of my opponents would have had a chance. But he said the most powerful instrument of intimidation is reckless accusation of anti-Semitism. They have succeeded in redefining what is anti-Semitic. Now, the dictionary reserves it to hostility to the entire nationality or religious community of Jews. But the Zionists have redefined that term so that in their eye, anti-Semitism occurs when even the slightest criticism of the behavior of the State of Israel occurs. That, of course, is far different from the dictionary definition, but I believe that the fear of being called anti-Semitic is the basic fear, the most powerful fear that keeps our country terrorized.
Well, I think that being politically corrupt has certainly gone overboard when it comes to this particular statement. We don't have to adopt that policy. So our next call is from Steve from Santa Fe. Steve is a great fan of our show, and welcome, Steve, to our show. Your question for the congressman.
Well, thank you, Bessemer, and thank you, Congressman Finn. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak to you and to listen to you talk to us, and I realize it. You know, it takes out of your time, and I appreciate it. You know, I'm really concerned about something that you bring up, you know, with the AIPAC and the Israeli Defense League having political action committees within our government, which I'm told are some of the biggest money spenders buying favors from our politicians. Is there anything we can do about that? I mean, I really don't think. I mean, just, you know, I agree with you wholeheartedly on what you're saying about Israel and the horrors that it has committed and is committing and as we speak, in fact. But for them to have more say in the political outcome in the United States of America than a common citizen like myself, I find, as a veteran and an American, to be really scary. Is there something we can do about that?
Well, there's reason for all of us to be frightened, because our political structure is just as terrified as the rest of the country, perhaps a bit more so, because almost everybody in office looks to the next election. And they will see what happened to me, what happened to Chuck Percy, what happened to Adlai Stevenson, what happened to Bill Fulbright, and decide we better go along, we better vote for everything that Israel wants if we want to get reelected. So that's a very sobering thought. I want you to know that even though I view the future in very dark tones, there are a lot of good people working hard to try to remedy this. I think of a couple of Foreign Service officers who, when they retired at the age of 55, and that was about 25 years ago, have each spent their income, their energy, their life in trying to make the Middle East better understood here in this country. Their names are Ambassador Andrew Kilgore and Richard H. Curtis, and they started the magazine Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. They have kept it afloat year after year. It's a splendid factual magazine. I also think of a man named Gene Bird, B-I-R-D, also a former Foreign Service officer, who is now the head of the Council for the National Interest. That's an organization I helped to found many years ago, but no longer are involved in day-to-day management. Gene, like Andy Kilgore and Dick Curtis, is literally giving his retirement years, his energy, his everything to try to make a difference in this battle against the lobby's influence, its destructive influence on the American people.
Thank you.
And there are a lot of other groups that I could cite, too, but those I'm quite close to. Allison Weir is another one. She was mentioned a little while ago. She's a Californian. She has no blood ties to the Middle East at all, but she is giving her life, and her main focus is the bias of the U.S. media at all levels, in all forms, and the reporting on the Middle East. They do not give the American people a fair report on what's happening. The Yiddish press, the Hebrew press in Israel, has a far better coverage of the pros and cons of Israeli behavior than our newspapers carry, and the British newspapers are the same. They do a good job, a good balanced job. And the U.S. media is totally intimidated by the lobby.
Thank you. Our next question is from Kevin. Our next question is actually from Arthur of Washington State. Arthur, will you please give us your question for the congressman? We're coming close to closing, guys, so let's try to keep it brief.
Well, it's great to hear from you, Congressman. And okay, my deal is, how come we are sending all our money and arms to Israel? There are more living in the States than Israel.
Well, if you take even the modest estimate of what the war in Iraq has cost, which is surely over $300 billion already, that could be.
I don't think he's hearing you.
Improve our lives in many, many ways. Provide a medical system, for example.
I think it's time we put our.
I'm sorry, Congressman. Could you repeat your answer? I don't think Kevin. I think we had some cross lines going on there.
Okay. Well, I said that all of the money being spent in Israel is on the cuff. In other words, they're borrowing every dime that's spent over there, over in Iraq, I mean, and in Israel, too. All of that's on the cuff. And by the way, the Christian Science Monitor now estimates that the total cost to the American taxpayer of aid to Israel since 1975 is no less than $1.4 trillion. Well, the spending in the Iraq War, and bear in mind, we wouldn't have this war at all if it wasn't for Israel. The cost of that war is surely well over $300 billion. Think what $300 billion could do here at home in relieving poverty, in bringing medical care to the uninsured today, in rebuilding the infrastructure of our country that so badly needs work. Just a staggering amount that we're investing there.
Thank you. Our next guest is Mike from California. Mike, will you come to the mic? We've got just a short time, Mike.
Thank you very much. Mr. Finley, I was wondering, could you tell me of the top candidates running for president, which of them are owned by the Jewish lobby, or which call
is the people running for president?
For instance, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards.
Tell you a few facts.
On the Republican side, I'm not so sure who the top Republican candidates are, but could you go down the line and just give me an assessment of how they voted? And, you know, what they're exactly going to get us into if they become the next president. Thank you.
Well, I can respond to that last phrase. I believe every Democratic candidate for president, with the exception, I don't think there are any exceptions on this, has already stated his support for any action necessary, including military action, against Iran, if Iran doesn't behave the way we think it should. Well, that's a pretty uniform position on an issue that obviously flies in the face of the U.S. national interest. Our national interest does not require that we destroy any part of Iran's nuclear facilities or any other part of Iran. We does not require that we go to war against Iran, and yet every Democratic candidate for president is on record favoring any measure necessary to keep the state of Iran from having nuclear facilities that can be made into weapons of war. Now, that's a pretty sweeping situation. Now, the Republican Party, I think, is pretty close to the same, although Dee Kucinich of Ohio and Ron Paul, I believe, dissent from that. They oppose this pledge of going to war in Iran. I hope they do, at least, and I believe that they have. Let me back up with just a little fact of history. Years ago, probably 30 years ago, a Jewish scholar wrote a book in which he tried to explain the power of Israel in America, and one of the facts he brought to light was that more than one half of the money that went to the Democratic National Committee, the committee that deals with presidential elections, came from Jewish sources. More than one half. Well, by the time Ronald Reagan was ready for his re-election, they were also providing one-fourth of all the money going to the Republican National Committee. So they are doing a pretty thorough job of buying both parties, and they're getting by with it, and there's hardly any mention of it, hardly any public outcry.